You're listening to Both Sides of the Stethoscope, where medicine meets the human heart. This podcast is hosted by me, Dr. Colby Salerno, a cardiologist, and my co-host, Dr. Aline Grigosian, an ICU doctor. What makes our podcast unique? We've both had heart transplants. Join us as we blend our medical expertise with personal journeys, aiming to educate and foster understanding between doctors and patients. From cutting-edge medical discussions to personal reflections, welcome to a podcast that explores the heartbeat of healthcare and the shared experience that connects us all. Let's get on with the episode. This episode is sponsored by Paragonix Technologies, an industry leader committed to protecting the gift of organ donation. To learn how Paragonix is reshaping the standard of care across transplantation to optimize patient outcomes, visit paragonix.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Both Sides of the Stethoscope. I am one of your hosts, Colby Salerno, with my co-host, Aline Grigosian.
Hi, everyone.
Tonight's episode, in my opinion, is extra special. We have on the caregiver of all caregivers, Sarah Siqueiros, who is the mom of three heart transplant recipients, Isabel, Jason, and Jackson. And again, we are just so excited to have you on. So welcome on, Sarah.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
We are so excited to have you here. And we will say that this is a re-recording because we did try to just record the first half of our podcast. So we're going to laugh a few times during this episode. And we're so sorry about that, Sarah. But we can just restart with what we had just asked you. I'm so sorry that you have to like retell the story, but it is such an incredible story. And we really want our audience to hear. There's two reasons why this is important. A, for our audience and people to see the side of, you know, what it's like to take care of three heart transplant recipients. And we're so grateful for that because me and Kobe are both heart transplant recipients. But even more than that, this is kind of giving a voice to the caregivers out there, which I always say is one of the most important parts of not just people with chronic illness, but particularly people with transplants. So we really appreciate you being here. And with that, I kind of want to ask you again, what is your story? What is your background? And what led to this crazy, very interesting story that you're about to tell us?
Yeah. So basically, we were just living our lives. We had welcomed our twin boys, Jason and Jackson, when our two-year-old daughter, Isabel, got sick. We thought she had just some cold or virus or something going on with cough and congestion. Her pediatrician thought she had croup, you know, gave her an oral steroid and sent us on our way. But as she continued to decline, we took her into Phoenix Children's Hospital, where the following morning she was diagnosed with a 1 in a million heart failure condition called restrictive cardiomyopathy. Basically, when the heart is too stiff, it can't pump blood properly. So they had informed us that she was likely headed for a heart transplant. But first, we had to get her stable enough to be listed if that was going to be the case. So we were in the CBICU for a couple weeks. The heart failure was so bad that it had caused fluids to back up in her lungs. And her liver was 5 times enlarged, but that's what was replicating the cold-like symptoms, was her lungs were completely full of fluid. So we started on the Lasix, the Melrinone, the Aldactoside, all the heart failure meds just to try to get her to a stable place to potentially be listed for a transplant, which we did. She got stable and we got to come home. But then the following week when we followed up with the transplant and heart failure team, they did recommend getting her listed right away as her condition was progressing pretty rapidly. So she was we went through the whole transplant evaluation and she was listed on to UNOS on March 15th of 2018. And she received her gift of life on May 20th of 2018, just 2 months later. And during this whole time, you know, we had the twins checked with echoes, EKGs, lab work at 3 months, and then again at 6 months. And luckily, they hadn't shown no signs of the restrictive cardiomyopathy. until after their first birthday later that year in November, when Jason had suffered his first of several cardiac arrests.
Wow. So if I, you know, I know we're laughing about this because we did talk about it a little bit, but it sounds like Isabel was in the hospital, correct, after her transplant when Jason suffered his first cardiac arrest?
Yes. So she came home from her transplant in about June, and 6 months later, she had developed gastroparesis from her transplant medication. So she was vomiting, she had stomach pains, and she was admitted for that. And I got a call at 1 o'clock in the morning from my mom saying that she had just called an ambulance because baby Jason woke up, he threw up, and he let out like a weird scream cry, and he was pale, and she was just worried. So she called an ambulance, and that they were transporting him to Thunderbird Hospital, which is our closest hospital to our home. So I left Phoenix Children's Hospital and I headed down to where he was. And the moment I walked in and saw him, I knew something was seriously wrong. He was completely pale. He was as pale as the sheet he was laying on. And within minutes of seeing him, he suffered his first cardiac arrest. It was only a few minutes. The doctors weren't even really sure what was going on. They thought potentially a seizure because of the way his eyes rolled up. But I was telling them that it was probably his heart. His sister had just had a heart transplant. And, you know, explaining everything to them. And they actually told me to come in and hold him. And as I was explaining everything to them, he went stiff in my arms again or suffered another cardiac arrest in my arms. And that time, I don't even remember walking out of the room. It almost felt like I floated out. And I'm just watching these doctors and nurses just working on him. And it was a terrifying sight. But they were able to get him stable. And they got us air evacuated to Phoenix Children's Hospital, where our heart failure team was. And they just started running a bunch of tests on him. And obviously, now he was showing signs of the restrictive cardiomyopathy, and he was having some arrhythmias that were a little bit different than what we saw in Isabel, a little bit more severe. So we spent the night there. Isabel was admitted on the sixth floor. Jason was admitted on the fifth. And in the morning, I brought Jackson, his twin, in through the emergency department just to check him. Just, you know, I had to, in my heart, make sure he was okay, given what just happened to his twin. And sure enough, Jackson was now showing signs of restrictive cardiomyopathy, as well as some arrhythmias that his brother was having. As Jackson was being admitted, I was talking to Isabel's GI doctor on the sixth floor. And my husband called and said that Jason was coding again. So I ran down to the fifth floor, ran to his room, but they told us to wait outside and they put the sheets up because they were preparing ECMO, because this time they weren't getting his heart beat back. So we waited for a little bit and they finally came and told us that they were able to revive him on the very last shock that they were attempting. And they got his heartbeat back and they rushed him to emergency pacemaker surgery or emergency surgery, where they did a temporary pacemaker to keep his heart beating. Because of the arrhythmias he was having, they couldn't do a defibrillator. So it had to be a pacemaker. So he came out of that surgery, and then we scheduled Jackson's pacemaker surgery as well. So I had all three children admitted at the same time. One was extremely critical. The other was for, you know, GI complications from transplant. And then Jackson was there because his was just the beginning and he was waiting for his pacemaker surgery.
Right. That's a very traumatic process that you probably went through as a caregiver. I do want to touch on a couple things. First, if you can touch on what it was exactly that caused all that, the diagnosis itself, And then also, and we can get to it after, is what was it like as a caregiver to see all of that happen, especially like simultaneously, basically?
Yeah, that is a part of my life that I will never forget. It was traumatic, to say the least. I was running from floor to floor and trying to be there for all three of them while feeling like I just needed to clone myself to be in three places at once, and I couldn't be. I obviously had to stay close by with Jason. He was so critical. He was coding, you know, left and right, it felt. Then poor Jackson was up there with no clue what was going on. He was there. The twins were only one and Isabel was two. So it was a very intense time. I honestly felt almost like a zombie, just walking through the motions every day, and none of it felt like real, even like this has to be a dream, a stimulation, something's going on. Like this can't really be happening. It was just unbelievable. And there were a lot of issues, and I didn't even have enough time to sit and think about my feelings because there was so much happening. Mm-hmm. Even after Jason got his pacemaker, he had so many complications. He had blood clots, which he was on blood thinners for, but in turn, those caused internal bleeding, a hemothorax, where we almost lost him again, and they drained almost 2 liters of blood from his chest cavity. And Isabel, who was just vomiting, and her Tacro was up to 30, and you know she was supposed to be at 10. And then Jackson just got out of pacemaker surgery, and he's just hysterical because he has no idea why he just went through all of this. So it was a very crazy, devastating time for our family, but we all made it home right before Christmas that year of 2018. So we're just grateful to have them all home. Both the boys had their pacemakers, and we thought we'd be good for a little bit.
That's incredible. My parents always say that they feel like, I mean, I wasn't a baby, I was 30, but to them, I'll always be their baby. They always say that, I mean, in Armenian, at least, it almost felt like it wasn't real, like it was surreal. And also, they remember so much more than I do. Like they remember every single time, like I was in pain. They remember all the time, like I had to get stuck for blood. I don't remember most of it. I was in a like medically induced coma, but my parents still have like trauma that they deal with, and I feel so bad. So I really appreciate that caregiver perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mentioned this previously, but I have two 1-year-old twin boys. And so hearing what your 1-year-old twin boys were going through just, you know, breaks my heart thinking about it. And, you know, my boys were just in the NICU for a little bit just because they were born early. And even then,
yeah,
I thought about how much easier it is to go through stuff myself. So going through my heart transplant and stuff to me was easier than having to watch my kids go through anything. So I can't even fathom you being in a children's hospital with 3 children all going through major, major things. And you really are, like I said, when we started this, the caregiver of all caregivers, in terms of what you do on a daily basis. So before we get into what your current day-to-day life has been like, tell us about kind of what led to eventually Jason and Jackson getting heart transplants as well.
Yeah, so they were doing really well with their pacemakers, and their heart function was still good, and everything was going smoothly for about a year and a half. On June 3rd of 2020, Jason dropped unresponsive in our kitchen, just completely out of nowhere. So I had to start CPR and call 911. This is right in the middle of COVID times. So the ambulance came and took him. I couldn't ride with him because of the restrictions. And by the time I got to Thunderbird Hospital, which is the closest hospital again, they were still working on him, doing chest compressions and just trying to get him back to us. And they eventually got him stable again. to be air evacuated to Phoenix Children's Hospital. And again, because of the restrictions, I couldn't go in the helicopter this time. So driving there, just not knowing if he was alive, was probably one of the more traumatic things that, besides, you know, having to do CPR on my own son, was definitely one of the worser parts of that day. But when we got to Phoenix Children's Hospital, his pacemaker doctor informed us that he had suffered a 40-minute ventricular fibrillation code, and it wasn't looking good. His labs were starting to come back with pretty devastating results. He had no signs of neurological function, and they just, without telling us to prepare, told us he is very sick, and, you know, we're going to do what we can, but you just need to be aware that he is very sick right now. And a couple days passed and nothing really changed. There was no ups, there was no downs. And then on the third day, he opened his eyes and he was trying to talk to us. And he was asking for Allah, water, and with the breathing tube down his throat, he was trying to talk. So they, as soon as that happened, they immediately listed him for transplant. They also got the paperwork started for his twin, Jackson, because he always kind of treaded a couple months behind Jason, so they weren't going to wait on Jackson. And then we got devastating news that both the twins were 100% sensitized, meaning they had a lot of specific antibodies that would make them a near impossible match for a transplant. But luckily, we had the amazing Dr. Stephen Zangwill, who did find a way to do a cross match. And 3 weeks later, we found out that Jason's heart was ready. About 3 hours before his scheduled transplant surgery, he coded again. And that one was I can't say was the scariest, because they were all terrifying, but the heart was there. He was so close. And then for him to code again, it was just, I was terrified. But luckily, the amazing nurses and doctors were able to get him stable within about 4 to 5 minutes. And they wheeled him off to the OR 3 hours early just to have him down there and ready. And the next time I saw him, it was 8 a.m. the next day, and he had his brand new heart. And as soon as, you know, the wires and the ventilator and everything came out, he was a brand new child. He was happy. He was eating. He was actually smiling. He had a face full of color. It was a complete change from how he was always kind of miserable and sick and in heart failure and tired. And it was an amazing thing to witness, truly. And then he recovered great. Everything was fine. He did have a injury to his leg from a infiltrate of epi they used trying to save him. So besides that big leg injury, he recovered pretty well, and we were home within about 2 weeks. He had a lot of physical therapy. He learned how to walk. There was a lot of things with him that we had to deal with, but our focus finally was able to turn back to Jackson. He had started to deteriorate even more. He stopped eating and playing, and he just lost so much weight that we were just afraid that his call was never going to come, it felt like. But then in September, 3 months after Jason's transplant, we got the call that Jackson's heart was ready. And we took him in, and we jokingly, but not jokingly, say he was our only like routine heart transplant. We took him in to the hospital. He got his surgery and he came home. There was no cardiac arrest. There was no, you know, theatrics about it. He was in and out, and he hasn't looked back since. He's been doing fabulous.
Yeah, you're probably one of the only people in the world who talk about having a routine heart transplant.
Routine heart transplant, yeah. Yeah.
Just for our listeners, just a little bit of background that I will give. So, you know, your three children were diagnosed with something called restrictive cardiomyopathy. And it is exactly kind of how it sounds, that the heart is restricted and it can't really relax and fill with blood the way a normal heart should. And in addition, it gets a lot of scar tissue buildup and fibrous material, which makes electricity the way it should run through the heart very difficult as well, which is why you can have all the abnormal heart rhythms that Jackson and Jason were having. And not, you know, just this is me guessing in part because of your story, but it sounds like they did not want to put defibrillators in them. One, because they're one-year-old babies, so they can't tell you if they get shocked by the defibrillator. And it sounds like based on the rhythms, they would have been getting shocked a lot. But two, you also mentioned that there was some heart block, meaning that the electricity from the top of the heart was not getting to the bottom of the heart. And that's why they needed the pacemakers. And so with that, I would love for you to explain a little bit about the genetic workup that was done and what was found with the three of them.
Yeah. So our first round of genetic testing was with Isabel, our daughter, when she originally got sick. And at the time, they didn't find much. There was a deletion in her DES gene that produced a muscle protein called Desmin. But at that time, it wasn't a cause of known cause of cardiomyopathy. It didn't fit in the panel of causes of cardiomyopathy. So they were pretty unsure if that was the cause or not. But then when the twins got sick, we went through our second round of genetic testing. And sure enough, they had that same deletion. So because they had it as well, our doctors were able to submit research on them in hopes to add this new condition to a list of the causes of cardiomyopathy, since all three of them had it. And my husband and I did both rounds of genetic testing, and neither of us carry that deletion. So we are still unsure of how or why this happened.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I think we had touched upon it during our version 1.0, but basically with these genetic cardiomyopathies, well, first of all, it sounds like yours was a deletion that had happened and it was passed on. But even with that being said, there's always, every single day in the field of genetic cardiomyopathy, genetic cardiology, there are so many new genes that are being found literally daily. When my dad had been diagnosed with cardiomyopathy, they didn't know that it was genetic. Back in the 1960s, when my grandpa had died, they said old age, but it was like 40 at the time, which I feel like it was something that we would have looked into nowadays. But at that time, when he had, you know, sudden cardiac arrest, nobody really looked into it. For my dad, never thought it was genetic. They just thought it was idiopathic. And then I had my heart transplant, my sudden heart failure. We finally did genetic testing and ended up having a genetic mutation. Now, me and my dad share it, so it was something that was passed on. But even with that, they're like, we're not 100% sure if it's that. So these are things that are being found every day. And I think it's just very interesting that, you know, it's not something that you or your husband passed on to your kids. It's something that had spontaneously happened. I think, Kobe, you had, a deletion?
I had a point mutation occur. And, you know, for me, we did know that it could be passed on in an autosomal dominant fashion, meaning that there would have been a 50% chance that my children would get it. So we did pre-implantation genetic testing so that I made sure I would not pass hypertrophic cardiomyopathy on to my children. And hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the severity that I had it was very much so like your children. And I'm not a geneticist, but I am, you know, very fascinated by genetics and cardiomyopathies. And to me, the story of your family with having three different children with the same genetic mutation, but also that not being found in you or your husband, just seems extremely, extremely rare. And right. I think is just a true, you know, real life example of how little we still know about genetics and how they work and what can be, you know, the genotype, which is the genetic manifestation, and then the phenotype, which is, you know, how does this manifest in humans? And so, you know, we tell patients all the time, you know, you don't want to be the rare case or the emergency case. And, you know, your family somehow has found yourselves in this so much, but I follow your Instagram and you guys do it in style and with smiles on your face at all times. So I'm just so impressed by everything that your family has gone through and the optimism that you continue to have.
Yeah, every day is a battle, mental health wise, but I just have to choose positivity for them. I don't want them to be scared, and they're fully aware of their special hearts and what's involved in a heart transplant. But I just try to make every day the best I can for them, and especially for their donor families, who I know would give anything for just one more day. So they keep us positive and they keep me smiling. So all the credit to our donor families.
So Aline and I have talked in previous episodes about, you know, taking medications and being immunocompromised and trying to go on vacations, wearing masks, all of that. So as best you can, take us into the day of a life as a mother of three immunocompromised heart transplant recipients with a crazy number of medications.
Yes. Luckily, each of them are down to two anti-rejection medications every single day. Obviously, as you know, every 12 hours they take them, but they're not on anything else. Luckily, we've gotten blood pressure done and fixed on Jason and any other medications or antivirals, bacterials, antifungals. All of those came off not shortly, 6 months to a year post-transplant. But every day I wake up, I do their meds, I get them their waters because water, they know, super, super important. We do virtual homeschooling. So they do go to school online. They have a teacher and a whole class, but we chose virtual because with three immunocompromised kids, they'd be homesick every day if they went to public school. I see our relatives' children that are sick every week. So I think it was the best choice for us, and they're learning a lot and they actually like it. But besides that, we just try to live our lives as normal as possible. We wear masks everywhere we go. We've yet, knock on wood, to catch anything too crazy that has landed us in the hospital. But we just take all the precautions necessary to keep them safe and well, and balanced diets, balanced water, medication changes. The boys are actually just going through a weird Tacro change right now where they were both super high for some reason. But every 3 months, they have their transplant appointments where we get labs drawn, and they have an annual cath to check for all the rejections and any heart disease going on. We actually just got some, I don't want to say bad news, but Jackson was showing some donor-specific antibodies on his last blood work. So we're waiting for those to come back to make sure they haven't multiplied. But it's a lifelong thing, as you guys know, that we'll be dealing with. But we just take it day by day, and we do whatever we can to protect them and their special hearts.
I will say that I think, you know, it's very tough, and I think Aline would agree with this, for me and her, very health literate physicians who, you know, have to take our medications and can easily forget and things. So I can't imagine you trying to lay out three children's worth of meds on a daily basis. And then I just saw, you know, you went to Disney World, which looked amazing for your family, but trying to bring all your kids' meds to that and be out in the sun and sunscreening them, and just kind of thinking about all the things that I try and be careful about, and you having to do three times that with kids who may not, I mean, they've been in the medical, you know, world their whole lives, so I'm sure they're very well versed compared to any other 6 and 7 year olds out there. But I you know, watching the videos of your family, I'm just blown away by what you're having to go through, and just really commend you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate thing that you're doing for, obviously, not just your kids, but in the world of organ transplantation. I think a lot of people don't realize, like, how much like baggage it comes with, right? And I feel like our caregivers are the ones who really, really have that perspective better than even we do sometimes. Do your kids have an understanding of what they have? Like, oh, how much of it do they understand? How much of it do they question?
They did. We've always been completely transparent with them, even down to you have to put sunblock on because of your medicine. We don't want you to get, you know, any type of skin cancer or anything like that. And just for their medications, you have to take these on time so your special heart doesn't get sick. They know that another child had passed away for them to be alive today. So they do understand that. We honor their donors every holidays and stuff. So they're a part of our family and we just like to include them and try to make it as positive as of an experience as it can possibly be. But yes, they're getting older and they're definitely understanding more. Isabel's a sweetheart and she's like, oh, maybe we can plant, you know, we had some flowers and so maybe we can plant it for my donor. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's really sweet. Like just surprised me out of nowhere. But yeah, they're really aware of what's going on. And the boys are finally getting okay with getting labs drawn so frequently. Isabel, I don't know. She was just always a rock star. She walks in there. She tells them she wants it in her hand. What vein? Like she was fearless.
Wow.
But the boys were very scared. They still are a little bit, but they're finally to the point where we don't have meltdowns as we're walking in for labs. But that was definitely the biggest obstacle for them is all the pokes. And why do we always have to go get blood draws? And why do I have to, why am I dehydrated? Why do I need more water? And it's like, well, you have your special heart. And, you know, luckily, but unluckily, all three of them are going through it together. So it's not just one or two, it's the three of them. They all have to do these things. They all have to take medicine. They all have to drink plenty of water, wear sunblock, eat right, you know, run and play and work out their hearts. So they do have each other. And that is, they're very fortunate to have each other. I feel like, especially as they get older, to lean on each other for advice and stuff that only a transplant recipient can go through. But yeah, they're taking it pretty well so far. And I'm just hoping it stays this way forever.
That's great. It's always hard to navigate. And again, I was a patient when I was 30. Kobe got his transplant in his early 20s. But I always wonder what it's like to actually tell younger patients, your kids, and how, because there are some parents who would rather not tell them everything, you know, they don't want to scare them, but I do think transparency is probably the way to go. I don't know what the best way is, but that sounds like it's the best way to me.
Yes. Yeah. And like with the Jackson's like donor specific antibodies, like I didn't tell him that.
Right. Right.
No, till it's an issue. But as far as like the big picture and the stuff they're going to have to do for the rest of their lives, I want to make sure they know, you know, even if, God forbid, mom's not here, you go in for your cath every single year. And they actually really enjoy caths now because they go to sleep and then they wake up and they don't feel their pokes. So they're pretty used to other things now that it's been. Isabel will be 6 years out in May and the boys are 3.5, 4 years later this year. So they've gotten pretty used to all the things that they have to go through and echoes and EKGs. And they know the drill now.
Yeah. Just complete rock stars of patients given everything they've been through. Was there any connections or anyone reaching out in terms of donor families trying to connect with your family?
I wish. I wrote all three families the moment I was able, but I haven't heard back from any yet. But we are here with open arms if they ever want to be a part of their lives. And I always get emotional talking about them just because they mean so much to us. So yeah, I wrote them. I haven't heard back yet, but I completely understand. I don't even know if I could write back if I was in their position. So hopefully one day we get to meet the families that saved ours.
Yeah, I think, you know, me and Aline deal in the world of adult medicine. So, you know, given the age of your babies, I know that that meant little babies that passed away to be their donors. So I can't imagine what you've been through, and I can't imagine the other side either. So I can see how maybe the ability to connect is a bit harder than it is for if you lose either an adult child or, you know, a husband or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. It's hard on everyone's end, I think. I always tell, you know, I work in I'm the medical director of the OP in California now. And I feel like it's a lot of times it takes time, right? Sometimes even 20 years down the line, then someone feels more comfortable. But I always make sure to tell people, not only from the donor's side, but also from the transplant recipients and their families' end, is that everyone is different. Yeah. People are more comfortable, some people aren't, but everyone is different. Everyone is going through their own hardships and struggles with, you know, and to see it all from my perspective, especially because I could see like the donation side going to the transplant side, it's still hard. So it's important that, you know, you're trying to reach out and, you know, who knows what the other families have gone through. It's hard for other people in different ways.
Oh, yeah. We have a transplant friend that it took, I think, 10 years before the family reached out to them. Yeah. I still have hope, but I also have kind of, you know, accepted what will be. And if they ever want to, we're here, like I said, with open arms. And if they ever want to listen to their hearts and be a part of their lives, they're the reason they are alive. So hopefully one day.
I did want to ask Sarah if there was any organizations or foundations that you would want to promote while we have you here on the podcast.
Oh, not obviously Donate Life. We have a little organization in Arizona called Transplant Families, run through a transplant mom that I know from Phoenix Children's, and she does a lot of good work for several CODA, you know, and so Transplant Families is probably the only one that comes to mind. Yeah, and Donate Life, and we're close. I actually have a speech I'm doing for Donate Life Arizona coming up here soon, just trying to raise more awareness for organ donation. Any way I can, just in case, you know, we need future transplants and for our friends that are waiting. And the biggest promotion I'd like to do is just encourage anybody listening to register as an organ donor if you haven't already, because you can truly be someone's life-saving superhero.
Yeah, I think we couldn't have said it better ourselves.
Thank you guys so much for having me on here.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us and to be so open and honest about your family's journey. I think there's got to be a lot of people out there that can resonate with you and what you've been through.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for listening to Both Sides of the Stethoscope with your hosts, me, Aline Gregosian, and Kobe Salerno. You can reach us at bothsidesofthestethoscope@gmail.com. You can also find us on both Instagram and Twitter. Our handles are Both Sides of the Stethoscope on Instagram and BSOT Stethoscope on Twitter or X. So you can find us on Both Sides of the Stethoscope on any of your favorite podcast platforms. Feel free to share or subscribe to our podcast. And if you really enjoy listening to us, we'd love to get a positive review.